We're talking about racism as a public health issue. A current report from UW Population of Health Institute shows health inequities are rooted in racism. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. More than 40 groups have signed onto a resolution that acknowledges racism as a public health crisis. We're talking about how to talk about it and what we can do to lessen disparities in our state. Join the conversation. What do you think? What have you seen as far as racism affecting people's lives? Do you believe that it's a public health crisis? Or what questions do you have about that kind of a declaration? You can give us a call. Email ideas@WPR.org or use the phone at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Pam Goodman. She's a clinical assistant professor in the College of Nursing and Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. And Pam is part of a statewide effort that resulted in the Wisconsin Public Health Association declaring that racism is a public health crisis here. Pam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you.
How can we say that racism is a public health crisis? What dots do we need to connect to recognize that that's just true?
Well, you know, the social constructs of looking at what we call the determinants of health are really a huge part of racism. When we talk about this from a population health perspective, we're looking at how do communities of color, ethnicities, where are they located, such as in housing? What has been the opportunities for education? What about transportation? What about equitable opportunities to live in neighborhoods that are safe and provide the best opportunities for everyone to be able to maximize their optimal health and well-being and contribute back to society? This is oftentimes difficult to talk about, and especially when we use the word racism, a lot of people really have some challenges in thinking about, well, you know, what about my own personal situations, or how does that relate to what I believe in, or how does that relate to my own ability to obtain health? But when you start to pull apart the issues around racism, we can recognize that it has a lot to do with power and the social constructs that we have in our society today. And that really affects health, because if you're not able to have these things as part of your own life and well-being, your health starts to suffer, especially over many decades and time that goes on. But we're seeing those effects today.
And there is certainly the conversation about opportunity that goes in so many directions. One thing we do know, though, is that when people experience these the lower end of disparities or inequities, someone's physical health changes simply because of the stress.
Absolutely. And we see this, you know, in our especially our African-American birth outcomes. Our infant mortality rates are horrible with our African-American babies. The ratio is, you know, twice the amount for those who have been that are born premature with our African-American babies. We see these disparities, especially so for African-Americans and other minorities in regard to the effect of obesity, cardiovascular disease, strokes, diabetes, and those equitable opportunities are not available because they haven't had as much of the ability to have equitable options, I should say, or opportunities where they can, you know, get to the healthcare that they need. And over time, as you mentioned, the stress that is involved as there is less opportunity for them to be able to have enough equitable opportunity for their housing, that adds up being very stressful. And we see this in the long-term outcomes.
Pam Goodman holds a doctorate of nursing practice, and we're talking with her about how racism is a public health problem. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this initiative? Do you see this happening in your communities? What makes you think that the state needs to address this issue? Or do you think that it should be on the individual to somehow figure out how to make this public health crisis better? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also always email us at ideas@wpr.org. Pam, let's springboard off of what you were just talking about. We have, higher death rates for African Americans and Native Americans at all stages of life in Wisconsin compared to other ethnicities. How do inequalities and disparities specifically factor into that? It's baked into our system.
It is baked into our system, and we have to disentangle all of that power, because when we have our system set up so that there are disadvantages for certain parts of our population, there is just little opportunity for them to be able to reach for that highest level of health. And so when we start to disentangle this, and from a statewide perspective, we have to do this. We have to do this for all communities, because when all of us are much healthier, we all are able to obtain a better, equitable way to also give back to our communities. So when you asked whether or not if I'm part of this statewide initiative, I am. And part of the task force that I have been on is about how do we talk about racism, and can we develop the language and the narrative about how we talk about racism? And, you know, I'm a low middle class woman, middle aged, and, you know, these are things that I am really working hard so that I can have better discussions. But I have to say that from a rural perspective, I have witnessed this with my own eyes. I'm a public health nurse. I like to be out in the field. I'm out in the communities. I've worked many, many years with people on the ground. And when you see what happens to people because of the stress that they have endured time and time and time again, and you recognize the inequities, it is time for us to do something at all levels, whether that's at an individual level, joining, being willing to listen to people who have experienced these types of disparities, also joining task forces, and just really understanding that we are all in this together. It's just really so very important.
I think it's striking, though, that not only do we see racism affecting people's emotional health, but it affects their physical health. Just years of suppression, something like feeling that leading to higher levels of hypertension. And then if you're having a baby, the likelihood of premature birth increases. I mean, there are real physical issues that come out of this.
Absolutely. And I think when we first started, I mentioned that our African-American babies have the highest percentage of preterm births at about 11.1%. That's twice the amount for us as whites. Also, for the national infant mortality rates in our Native Americans and Alaskan Natives, they have a 60% higher infant mortality rate than whites, and that's 2014 data. So we know that these types of challenges occur for our health outcomes, and in addition to our mental health. The MMWR, which is out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2017 noted that the health status for the quality of life is that's fair or poor is at 28.8% for blacks versus 18.5% for whites.
Yeah, so you can hear that difference. Pam, I want to jump in here. We're talking about racism as a public health problem with Pam Goodman. You're part of this conversation. Maybe you work in healthcare. What do you see as far as inequities and disparities and how that affects families' health? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Health professionals acknowledge that housing, transportation, and education are all factors that affect a person's well-being. So when people are at a disadvantage in those areas, their health suffers. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you. Do you work in healthcare, or do you see people being affected by racism? What do you consider the root causes of this inequity that we have across races when it comes to health and wellness? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Maybe you see solutions to some of the challenges that we have in even starting the discussion about racism as a public health crisis. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Pam Goodman. She holds a doctorate of nursing practice, and she's also a clinical assistant professor in nursing at UW Eau Claire. Pam, let's talk a little bit more about your personal connection to this. We've seen 40 different organizations sign on to the declaration that racism is a public health crisis. You've also signed on personally. And why did you make that distinction?
Well, I have primarily focused for nearly 30 years of my nursing career in public health. And I signed on personally because I understand as best as I can from a rural inequity perspective. And rural inequities, and for those who are of minority African-American that also are rural, the disparities for health outcomes is even worse. And so when I obtained my doctorate degree from the University of Minnesota, a lot of my training and education was along these similar lines around those determinants of health that you just mentioned. And I joined a health equity narrative work group, which is one of the three factors that we are working on to try to advance health equity in the state of Wisconsin. So when I looked at the declaration that the Wisconsin Public Health Association, which I'm also a member of, had put together, it identified everything that I have learned. It's also very personal to me as having been an advocate for rural populations for the last 3+ decades. And so that's part of the reason of why I joined on. Plus, in addition, you can see that the challenges are increasingly worsening when we are not addressing these particular issues in healthcare.
How should we think about the nexus between the issues that face people in rural areas of the state and racism? We know that many of Wisconsin's minority populations are condensed in bigger cities.
Right, but the when you really start to pull apart the issue around racism and you start to understand the significance of power, and for those who haven't had the ability to have their voice heard, to be listened to, we start to understand that there are extreme similarities to this power that has been centered around white privilege, and primarily more of those who have a lot of wealth and power in powerful positions that really haven't been encompassing of the voices that need to be heard. And I think about this from a previous administrator experience that I had as a community action agency director. And this is something that community action agencies, anti-poverty organizations really try very hard to help provide equitable and also the opportunity for people who have had suppressed voices to really have them be part of the conversation, to really take hold of the power themselves, and to empower them to become part of the solution to really change the narrative and to change the outcomes that we so desperately need in our state and across our country.
Pam Goodman is a population health nurse educator, and she teaches at UW Eau Claire. And there's room for you in our discussion about racism as a public health crisis. Have you experienced health inequities? How do you see that your opportunities are different than those of other people? Do you consider yourself part of a minority population? What do you want other people to know? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And we have Tom from Burlington on the line as part of this discussion. Tom, thanks for your call.
The hidden cost of racism is poor people have a poor diet. They can't get access to good food. they can't get access to good jobs either. We didn't build a light rail system in Milwaukee to get people to the suburbs, because it's really racism that holds them back and surrounds them. In the poorer districts of the city, people substitute bad food for good food. We don't have the supermarkets there that are going to give them good food, and this costs us. The bad diet costs us, they say, $1 trillion a year. It's a hidden cost that people aren't aware of, and it's just so sad that we have this secret racism that is built around everything economically. And I don't know how to really get over it if we could just maybe improve our school.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tom, for that call. Pam, Tom hits on a lot of different points, talked about transportation, access to food, and how that, substituting lower cost foods, lower quality foods can change people's health, too. And I mean, it's a really complicated system. How do we even begin to wrap our minds around it?
Thank you, Tom, for your call. And you did hit the nail right on the head. And I appreciate all of those factors of health that you brought up. How do we really have these conversations, and how do we extrapolate the power that's involved? And that is, again, is part of the narrative network that task force that I'm on. And, you know, I think that just as Tom identified, we have to have these discussions. We have to be challenged. And again, I brought up listening, active listening as a nurse. I've been trained for many years, and I'm now currently training our new nurses to really stop talking and to listen, actively listen, to understand what it is to have less opportunities. We talked about food deserts, as Tom brought up, as well as transportation issues. Those voices haven't been heard. We haven't provided or haven't allowed that power to listen and to make active changes so that we can make differences for overall health outcomes. When we talk about food deserts, as Tom referenced, what happens is that, you know, you're working 2-3 jobs if you're able to access a job that you can get to, and if there's, you know, adequate financing coming in so that a person can get to that job. And when you have food deserts, you are relying on the fast food industry that is centered in many of our areas of low income, both in low income areas such as in inner city Milwaukee, but also low income areas in rural northwestern Wisconsin. So you grab, you know, a fast food meal that costs less money. And Tom is right. Those health outcomes are poor. We see that in the diabetes and also in our high stroke and our high cardiovascular disease rates that disproportionately affect people of color and negatively affect their overall health outcomes. And, you know, why should we be concerned about this? Well, it doesn't make economic sense, as in CENTS or in regular sense, SENSE, that we're not really looking at this from a perspective that allows everyone to get to the highest level of health and their overall well-being. Because when you feel good, when you're able to physically and mentally contribute back to the society, you help produce a much better, well-robusted economic entity. And that's needed for the state of Wisconsin as well as our entire nation.
Pam, we acknowledge that the data proves that there are disparities between white Wisconsinites and people of color. Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, emailed to say, though, what am I supposed to do as a white person to help people you seem to be saying aren't really different from me after all? So having trouble understanding, you know, whether we have the same opportunities or we don't, and how we work together there. What do you think?
Well, again, I would say that being willing to listen, being willing to reach out, find organizations, look at this declaration that the Wisconsin Public Health Association has identified, read, have conversations with neighbors. Let's talk about this and not be fearful or not be afraid to open up those conversations. And again, to have that active listening, to understand what it is like to not have the same opportunities to achieve the highest level of health and well-being. When I look at, again, the African-American percentages for leisure time physical activity in the past month, it's different at 38.2% that they've not had that ability versus whites at 27.7%. And so what does that mean? Can we be involved? Can we make a difference somehow in our own communities? Can we open up this conversation? Are you on a board of some type? Are you, you know, attending school board meetings? Are you part of the policy discussions that are going on? And just open up to have conversations, at least to get more of this out on the table, and then really commit to action.
All right. I appreciate you going into all of those areas to help us understand how we might be able to try to make a difference here. Pam, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the conversation.
Pam Goodman is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Nursing and Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. She holds a doctorate in nursing practice, and we've been talking about how racism is a public health problem. Up next, we're looking at Wisconsin's school safety plans and guidelines intended to protect students and staff. Our guest explains how schools are using new funds to handle active shooter situations. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Morning Show. Students across Wisconsin are done with winter break today. They're back in schools that try to keep them safe from gun violence. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin doled out $100 million in grants for schools in the wake of the deadly shooting in Parkland, Florida back in 2018. Most schools use the money on surveillance cameras, intercom systems, and electronic door locks. What do you think? What questions do you have about the way schools approach safety, especially when it comes to firearms? You can ask now at 800-642-1234. Amy Klinger is founder of the Educator School Safety Network, a nonprofit organization that provides school safety training and resources to schools across the country and beyond. She's also an associate professor of educational administration at Ashland University in Ohio. Amy, thank you for joining us here on The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
When we make changes in schools, when we upgrade those physical measures like locks on the doors, surveillance systems, should we feel safer being able to lock the doors and monitor what's going on?
Well, it depends. If that is the only thing that we do, then not necessarily. If that is part of a larger comprehensive plan that looks at all hazards, that looks at ways to prevent, not just respond to violent acts, if it's part of a larger system of supports and interventions for students, if it's part of threat assessment, then yes. But if it's the only thing we're doing, just installing that door lock and going, now everything's fine, no, that doesn't make us any safer.
And do you find the schools have comprehensive plans as far as school safety, or do you see big gaps in the situations, the things that they've accounted for?
We see a couple of big gaps, a couple of troubling things. One is the idea that schools are spending a lot of time and energy and money focusing on just active shooter events, which clearly that's a horrific act, and it's something that everyone fears and something that is also statistically very rare. And so the concern is if we're spending 100% of all of our time, training, energy, money, and attention on the least likely event, are we adequately prepared for the things that are much more likely to happen? An accident, a non-custodial parent, a medical emergency, a severe weather event. Are we equally prepared for those things? And that's one of the concerns that we have. The other is this notion, and you already mentioned it, of surveillance versus support. So we're surveilling students, we're treating them like inmates, we're watching them, but we're not necessarily developing the relationships and putting appropriate support and intervention in place that's going to help us to identify individuals who are at risk for violence against themselves or others and prevent it and intervene. So those are two troubling trends that we see happening quite extensively throughout the United States.
You mentioned surveilling students like prisoners. Also, we see metal detectors that can create that sort of law enforcement feel among students. And certainly that is linked to some diminished academic performance. I think advocates for those sorts of measures would say, but if we stop someone with a gun, if we keep a knife out of a school, then we're willing to take that trade-off. How do we decide and deal with that cost-benefit analysis of something like metal detectors?
Well, metal detectors are a good example of, you know, the RAND Institute study that came out a year or so ago. I was unable to determine whether any of these technology-based measures are effective. The only one they were able to really look at was the fact that metal detectors don't work. That's the only thing they were able to definitively prove from that study. And so if you say, well, if we keep out one gun, the metal detector probably is not going to do that. We've seen numerous shootings in schools that had metal detectors. So the question is, if we want to prevent violence of all kinds, then we have to look at what's effective, not just what someone is advocating for or what an individual company or group is saying, this, you should buy this thing because we're selling that thing. As opposed to, do we really know in a very objective fashion what things work and what things don't? And the reality is, objectively, not one solution is the only thing we should be doing. We need to be doing an array of things. It is difficult to prevent violence, but it certainly is possible. But it's not possible if you just plop a metal detector in the lobby and go, okay, now we're safe.
Amy Klinger is founder of the Educators School Safety Network. She's an expert in active shooter response and in crisis planning. And we want to hear from you this morning. Tell us about your experience. Have you seen things in your child's school, like new security systems? Does that put you at ease? Or maybe you worry that schools are missing the bigger picture. Perhaps you're a teacher heading back in this morning. What's happening at your school? And how can you take care of your students physically, but also emotionally when dealing with these sorts of circumstances? 800-642-1234. That's the number that you can call. And you can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Amy Klinger, here in Wisconsin, it turns out that an audit done in December showed that some school safety plans here don't have much information about handling certain situations, things that are specifically outside of the classroom that are emergencies. How should we think about school safety plans when it comes to things like, you know, recess, athletic events, those extracurriculars?
Yeah, and that's very typical. We see a lot of instances where school plans, and keep in mind with that, also training. It's not enough to just write it down. Are we actually training in it? We see where school plans and trainings typically are very deficient in the areas of after school, large-scale events, non-traditional times like, you know, lunch, before school, after school, those particular times. But yet we know that statistically more of those events happen during those times. We also see that there are certain crisis events that aren't even addressed in many plans. Bomb threats are often addressed, but yet actual detonations are not, or suspicious packages are not. Oftentimes they don't address de-escalation. They don't address an intruder that comes in that's not an active shooter, but yet is in the building in an unauthorized fashion. So there's a lot of those things that aren't being addressed in crisis plans, number one, but more critically, are never addressed in any kind of training. If you look at the type of training that educators, the people with boots on the ground, those folks are typically receiving active shooter training, and that's about it. And that's very concerning because your child's school probably will not have an active shooter, but I guarantee it will have some sort of crisis event. Typically, schools don't have enough supervision. They typically don't have enough training for people in de-escalating situations or in how to communicate and respond. So there's lots of areas of deficit that extend way beyond active shooter training.
And we want to welcome Rosa from Waterford into the conversation now. Rosa, what are your thoughts here?
Hi. Well, it's interesting. My son's going to Waterford High School, and we recently hired a full-time police officer. And I'm happy that happened. And I found out in the 80s, a federal law was passed banning guns in all schools. So I think we should just bring that back. In fact, 92% of the mass shootings occur in high school. So the shooters know, hey, there's a federal law banning guns in schools. So I think, hey, let's revert back to how it was before the 80s. Let's bring guns back in schools so a shooter will know, hey, I better not go in this school because someone might have a gun.
All right, Rosa, thank you for your theory there. It sounds like Rosa is an advocate for maybe something like armed sentinels in schools. We have seen schools move in that direction, arming teachers or resource officers while inside the building. Amy?
Yeah, and we've certainly seen that as a trend. I guess the concern is people really need to think about that in an informed fashion. We know that there have been several, even recent, within the last 4 or 5 years, several shootings where you had armed individuals in schools already and it didn't prevent it. So, you know, if you take a campus with 1,000 kids and you have 2 people with a gun, what's the likelihood that they are actually going to be in the place and time where they can actually prevent that? You know, you look at shootings like Arapahoe High School. It was an 87-second event, yet you still had several fatalities. You had an armed SRO on scene. You had the shooting lasted 87 seconds, and you still had fatalities. So we need to be really careful that we're not just taking a very simplistic approach, which is let's give everyone a gun and let's see, you know, and that's going to somehow stop people from coming in, or that somehow they're going to magically be in the right place at the right time to stop that event. So it's really critical that we think about the unintended consequences of the things that we're putting in place. We also know numerous instances of where the guns that are in school are used inappropriately. They are lost or stolen. Someone takes one, you know, and so you also have to think about the mindset of educators in terms of people did not go into education because they wanted to be law enforcement. So we also have to think about, is there a way that we can pull together a comprehensive array of things that will help to prevent and respond to all kinds of violence, rather than just saying, we're just going to pass out a lot of guns and have armed people walking around in schools. We are moving closer and closer and closer to a prison. And there is a cost to our kids to be in an armed situation where they are searched and surveilled and where people with weapons are patrolling around them. There is a cost, and we have to decide if we're willing to pay that cost.
Amy Klinger is here talking about gun violence in schools, founder of the Educators School Safety Network, which provides school safety training and resources across the country. We're talking about how schools have used government funding to add safety measures, and we're learning what's missing that still allows gun violence to happen in schools. Your calls, your thoughts, welcome at 800-642-1234. If you're a student, what is your school doing to keep you safe? And what do you think they're doing right and maybe something they could do better? Do you think we're putting too much pressure on schools to try to fix this? Do you think social media makes the problem worse? You can email ideas@WPR.org or, again, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. When we put our kids on the bus or they bound out of the car in the drop-off lane, parents don't know what lies ahead. Will they listen to the teacher? Will they get along with their friends? Will someone bring a gun to school? Statistically, it's not likely. But after the tour guide talks about active shooter drills before your kid goes to kindergarten, or you've gotten a robocall that classes in your district are on lockdown, we're acutely aware that it's a possibility. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about how schools are using funding to try to prevent gun violence in a space our kids are supposed to be safe. There's room for you in this conversation. What questions do you have or thoughts do you want to share? Call us at 800-642-1234. Want to bring Michael from Milwaukee into this conversation now. Michael, thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
What's your question this morning?
I had a comment. I kind of agree with your caller. We need to do more, and there's a lot more things we need to do. But I think this highlights the psychological nature of what's going on in schools. With children, I mean, children are a lot more perceptive than we give them credit for. They feel more. They hurt more from depression and from being bullied and all this other stuff that happens in school. And I don't think enough is done. I mean, I remember when I was in high school and I was bullied a little bit. The bully just got a slap on the wrist and nothing else happened. And it, for me, it created a lot of resentment. So I think we need more, like, psychologists, more training in trying to manage these kids' feelings and not let them get so hurt to the fact that they get so angry that they want to do this, that they want to bring it down to school and shoot somebody.
Michael, thank you so much for that insight. Amy Klinger, founder of the Educators School Safety Network. Sounds like Michael is really trying to figure out how to solve this comprehensively, not just keep guns out of schools, but support kids so they don't even have to go there.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's right. We know it from research on past school shootings and violent events that a student, you know, the perpetrators oftentimes feel that they are being persecuted, that they are being injured or picked upon, you know, in some way. And the problem for schools, which is a really tough order, is that in many cases, that is true. There may be bullying going on. But in an equal number of cases, it's the perception. So you have a child that feels alienated, it doesn't feel supported, that feels like everyone's against them. They're unable to accept responsibility for their actions. They have been told throughout their whole life that they're never at fault, that they're always a victim. And so we have equal problems with that. We have kids who are legitimately being bullied. And then we also have kids who have been, in many ways, raised to believe that they have a chip on their shoulder, that there is someone against them, someone's out to get them. We have kids with very poor coping skills who don't have a lot of resiliency or grit, who aren't able to bounce back from minor setbacks. So getting cut from the baseball team becomes a catastrophic event for them that they're unable to, in many ways to come back from. And so that is a really critical piece. There is that emotional, the mental health piece. And I guess the larger consideration is, you know, schools are a reflection of society. We take the students that come to us. We work with the constraints that we have. So, you know, I think it's important for us as citizens of our country to go, if we don't like what's happening in our schools, we need to look at what's happening in our homes too, because schools are a reflection of that. So if we have kids who are having problems at home, of course they're going to have problems at school. And so it really needs to be much more of a collaborative approach to this, not just looking at schools and going, hey, solve this problem. And then schools look at law enforcement and say, hey, solve this problem. We're all in this together, and everyone has skin in the game to solve this problem.
All right, let's bring Sue Ann from Wausau into this conversation. Sue Ann, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Hi there. What's your question this morning, or what did you want to say?
Well, a moment ago, you had a caller who called in and suggested that we bring guns back into the schools as a way to protect students. Excuse me. I understand that there is no one fix to this problem. Having schools in or out of the building are not going to prevent any shooting. However, I want to know why so many people, why your speaker, oppose arming, training teachers as a way to further protect their students. I myself am a teacher, and I find it almost ridiculous that the only training I have is to hide my students in a dark corner of a room and hope that the shooter doesn't enter my room.
And Sue Ann, I have a follow-up question for you, and that is, would you feel more prepared in these circumstances if you were trained and armed at that point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I understand that part of my job when my students are in my classroom is not only to educate them, but to protect and help them in any way possible. They have a family problem. They have an issue. I'm there for them. If there is an outside threat, I am the one who could possibly stop them. How many teachers in school shootings have physically put their bodies between their students and the shooter as a means to protect them? Give me some way to protect them further.
Sue Ann, thank you so much for the call. Amy Klinger, you know, you lead the Educators School Safety Network. And Sue Ann's experience is, I want to do everything for my students possible. I mean, this is how teachers approach school safety. They want to protect their students, you know, comprehensively. So how do we begin to figure out what that looks like when there are so many elements to it?
Oh, but yeah, absolutely. And Sue Ann is reflective of every educator we work with who is willing to do whatever it takes to keep their students safe. The problem comes in that that's a continuum of things. So we need to, you know, and she raises a great point of the only training she has is to hide in the corner and hope for the best, which is not in any way in compliance with what the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Education came out in 2013 and said, you need to have multiple options. You need rapid evacuation. You need to be able to barricade. You need to have all sorts of options for active shooter response. So if you consider those as a, if you consider responding as a continuum, we need to train teachers all along that continuum. We can't just say, we're not going to give you any training other than to hide in the corner. But we also can't say, you know what, the only training we're going to give you is how to shoot. We have to give teachers a continuum of training, from how do I identify the troubled student that Sue Ann referred to? How do I intervene in that student's life? What kind of supports and interventions can I offer? What can I do if there is a severe weather event? What do I do when that non-custodial parent barges into my classroom screaming for their child? What do I do when that kid has an epileptic seizure in front of me and has some unknown medical condition that I don't know what to do with? Think of that array of things that a teacher faces every single day, and then compare that against the tiny, tiny amount of training that we actually give them. And then we wonder why teachers are willing to do literally anything to protect their students, but we aren't willing to give them the training to do so. And it can't just be one day of training or an hour of training or a couple of days of gun training. It has to be a comprehensive, ongoing, systemic training for all of the things that we're asking teachers to deal with. And that's just not happening.
Amy, we just have about a minute left, but I do want to help make sure that parents understand what they should be advocating for. You know, what power lies in parents, and what should we be saying to schools about what we need for our students?
Well, I think that's a great point. I think it's really critical that parents can advocate for more than just saying, we want you to buy an app, or we want you to buy a door locking thing. Parents need to be advocating for training. Education is a people business. We need to invest in people, not stuff. For every dollar you spend on stuff, you should be spending a dollar in training. And that's the way that parents can really make a difference. Because what we have to remember is a child that dies in school because they get hit by a bus because we didn't have enough supervision, that is an equal tragedy to the child that gets shot in school. Those are both horrific tragedies that need to be prevented. So parents can really advocate for an all-hazards approach that makes equal weight of training and expenditures on stuff.
Amy, thank you so much for this conversation. We've been talking about gun violence in schools with Amy Klinger. So much more to talk about in the future, too. Amy's founder of the Educators School Safety Network. You've been listening to this conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network.